This is New Testament Theology, cassette number 11, side B. We pick up now and continue with the Gospel of John. We were talking about the title Son of Man, and we want to say finally that it goes without saying that the use of this title in the Gospel of John and in the Gospels in general is theologically significant in that it reminds us, alongside the Gospel presentation of the deity of Christ, it reminds us of the humanity of Christ. And the Gospel of John, known for its emphasis upon the deity of Christ, does present him nonetheless as a real human being, and there's a strong sense of balance in the Gospel of John and in the Gospels in general, in their emphasis upon both the deity of Christ and the humanity of Christ through various means, and primarily by the use of the two titles, Son of God and Son of Man. Now we wish to talk a bit about discipleship in the Gospel of John. Again, we don't need to reinvent the wheel here. We will simply try to highlight some of the unique accents of this Gospel as far as discipleship is concerned. There's a lot more emphasis upon being with Jesus in this Gospel, the disciples being with him, the followers of Jesus being with him and being in his presence. I refer you to a strong emphasis upon this at the outset of the Gospel in chapter 1, verses 35 through 39. There's a strong emphasis upon ministry in this Gospel. John chapter 9, the entire chapter, I believe, is a chapter in many ways not just about the healing of a man born blind from birth, but implicitly about ministry and the very nature of ministry. And then this Gospel ends, we notice, on a strong note of ministry, with Jesus reinstating Peter, instructing him three times about taking care of the sheep, tending the sheep and feeding the sheep. In the Gospel, we find the strong emphasis upon ministry in the episode of foot washing, emphasizing servanthood, John chapter 13, a valuable piece on what ministry is all about. John chapter 10 and the Good Shepherd, we can say that here we have teaching on ministry as well, and what true leadership is all about, what good shepherding of God's people is all about, as opposed to the hireling, the one who doesn't really care about the sheep. So there are numerous ways in which this Gospel challenges us in what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, to walk in his presence, to place our faith and trust in him, to believe in him, and to walk in the way that he walked. This is how we show that we take seriously our belief and our discipleship, is by doing as he has done, turning from our sin and walking in his way and in his presence by the power of the Spirit, which he gives following his death and resurrection from the dead. We might, as a matter of fact, take a closer look at one of the passages, which I believe shows us something of the subtlety with which this Gospel presents to us ministry. It's John chapter 9 and the healing of the man born blind that we've already referred to. Let's use this passage as a bit of a window, exegetically speaking, into something of the theology of this Gospel as a whole. Beginning with 9:1, as he passed by, he saw a man blind from his birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night comes when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." As he said this, he spat on the ground and made clay of the spittle and anointed the man's eyes with the clay, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Now, we won't take the time to read the chapter in its entirety, but the whole chapter I heavily recommend to you for reading and careful study. We read enough of it to get some insight now into what's going on in this chapter. It's fascinating, the question which the disciples put to Jesus, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Apparently, there was a debate among the rabbis about the capacity of the unborn child actually to commit sin in the womb of the mother. But even more important than the immediate background in Judaism in Palestine, we might ask more largely about the background in humanity. There's a question here of theodicy. Why is there suffering to begin with? The age-old question. Why? You know, what's going on here? A question that the book of Job wrestles with, one of the oldest books of the Old Testament. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? This is a long-standing kind of philosophical question, philosophical debate here. And Jesus simply answers, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be made manifest in him. Jesus refuses to take a situation of human need and make it into fodder for a debate over the origin of sin or over the reason for suffering in this world. Very simply put, this was not an occasion for such a debate as this in the eyes of Jesus. Rather, it was an occasion for ministry. Now, too often, we stop with the first half of that verse, Jesus' declaration in that verse, but that the works of God might be made manifest. And we lose sight of a little prepositional phrase at the end, in him. What we miss is the ministry dynamic going on here. The glory of God being manifest, this sign being done to direct us to God in a concrete act of ministry, compassion, as far as a needy human being is concerned. Jesus says, in essence, this is not a time to engage in philosophical debate, to settle the question of theodicy, but this is a question of ministry, suggesting to us that the proper response to sin and suffering in the world, first and foremost, is not to engage in philosophical debate, but simply to roll up our sleeves and to minister. Now, there's a place for wrestling with these kinds of questions, sure enough, but I think the passage as a whole might be a sort of subtle challenge to us in some of our tendencies to sit around and debate these things and slice them up theologically at the expense of doing the truth that we've talked about in this theology course, doing what we know to be true, engaging in ministry, being a part of the manifestation of the glory of God in ministry. And when you read this entire story, and I encourage you to read it very carefully, you see the course which this sequence of events takes. The fact is, this man was healed on the Sabbath day, which causes the religious leaders to be very upset. They interrogate him several times. They even interrogate his parents. This man is quite naive. All he knows is that he was once blind, now he can see. They're trying to use it as an occasion to trap Jesus and to gain power for themselves in face of the threat that Jesus and his influence is posing for them and their exercise of authority. You see a tremendous playing out of the purposes of God in spite of the purposes of man, and there's a real subtle play on belief and disbelief. The Pharisees end up being the blind ones at the end of the story. And Jesus finds the man after he has been kicked out of their assembly. They become very impatient and upset with him, and they kick him out. And Jesus finds him at this point of need as well, and ultimately calls him to faith in himself. So Jesus, when the whole story is played out, Jesus has ministered to this man as a whole human being. He has healed him of his blindness, but he has dealt with his spiritual self as well, calling him to faith in himself. This man ultimately becomes a follower of Jesus, comes to sight, to see, and to believe. So I recommend it as a wonderful picture of what ministry is all about in a real world where there are real hurting people and real questions about that hurting. We have a kind of manual here of proper Christian response to suffering and hurting. And this gospel, I remind you once again, ends not with Jesus enjoining the disciples to engage in philosophical and theological debate, to get all the answers right, to get all their apologetic P's and Q's in a row, their ducks in a row and their P's and Q's straight, but instead to minister. Feed my sheep, tend my lambs, feed my sheep, look after the sheep. There's a strong note of ministry upon which this gospel ends, consistent with the very ministry, the pattern of the ministry that Jesus has revealed for the disciples, and that John has shown us through this revelation in the Gospel of John of what ministry is all about through the person and ministry of Jesus himself, a ministry ultimately which is empowered by the Holy Spirit, the giving of whom is to be closely associated with a ministry involving the forgiveness of sins, the practice of God's mercy and God's compassion, John chapter 20, verses 19 to 23. Now we move on in our treatment of the Johannine writings to deal with the Johannine epistles, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. We have an interesting situation with these epistles in our canon. In 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, we've got some rather explicit connections between letters of the New Testament and one particular gospel singled out, that is the Gospel of John. There's an explicit apostolic connection associated with these epistles that we find emphasized in the openings of the epistles. John is one who has been with Jesus from the beginning, and attests to what, by his account, we have heard, we have seen with our eyes, we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, so on and so forth. Strong testimony here to apostolic connection between these writings and apostles, those who were with Jesus. And what is even more fascinating is the ways in which this particular set of writings, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, echo one particular gospel, the Gospel of John. There are explicit and subtle references to the Johannine gospel tradition by way of a lot of the imagery and material and such that we find, have already found in the Gospel of John. In the Johannine epistles, we find the emphasis upon abiding, upon love, water and blood mentioned, sacrifice, and so on and so forth, very similar to the way in which we meet these in the Gospel of John. I know of no particular canon controversies associated with these epistles, or with 1 John in particular. 2 and 3 John might appear variously in early lists of the canon, but it's easy to understand why these might not appear in one list or another because of their very specific address and the specific purposes for which they were written, and therefore not maybe to be as widely appreciated early on in the life of the church as was the case later in the process of canon formation. These writings are characterized by very, very, very simple Greek style. We've already talked about. There's nothing very remarkable as to their form within the canon, except to say that the epistolary form is not followed very closely with 1 John, but it is followed with 2 and 3 John. 1 John openly acknowledges its derivative authority and validity as based in the gospel tradition, mediated again through apostolic witness, but with a unique tie to the Gospel of John. I refer you to 2 Peter and the canonical function of 2 Peter to reinforce a sense of the gospel tradition as foundational to the epistles. These writings reinforce the relevance, a sense of the relevance and usefulness of the Gospel of John in the life of the early church, giving us insights into how one particular gospel and the Christology of that gospel were applied in a pastoral setting. I think it can be said that in in some ways with this particular writing, what 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, we find pastoral applications of the Christological emphases and the presentation of discipleship characteristic of the Gospel of John. Here, all of that is pastorally applied in the life of the early church. And this can help us hermeneutically to see how we are likewise to go about applying what we find in the foundational writings called our Gospels in the life and ministry of the early church as we address problems and situations that we face. It's difficult, given the nature of these writings, to establish much in the way of overall theological structure with them. In the case of 1 John, at the outset, we notice that there really is not a typical epistolary form. There's no strict naming of addressees, and the epistle itself ends on a rather abrupt note, kind of famous to me for its abruptness. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. Now, addressees are mentioned in the body of the epistle, and we notice varied language by which the author addresses those to whom he is writing. We probably best think of this piece as a kind of homily or even polemical treatise written to counter some Christological problems and some practices associated with those Christological problems in the life of the early church. The author refers to the addressees as my little children, beloved. My little children at 2:1, beloved 2:7, fathers 2:13, young men 2:13, children 2:14 and 2:18. Whatever we can say about the original addressees, the writer shows a definite pastoral tone and a kind of established pastoral relationship, it seems to me, with the ways in which the writer talks to the recipients of the letter. There's a warm tone about it, respecting the dignity of these people, and yet a kind of established father-to-children relationship at the same time, under the circumstances, whatever they might have been. Second and Third John, by contrast, do follow more strictly the conventions, something of the conventions of epistolary form, with distinct openings and bodies in closing, although there are some curious and metaphorical elements associated with those openings and closing. Second John, the elder to the elect lady and her children, perhaps a metaphorical reference to the church to whom John was writing on this occasion, whom I love in the truth, and not only I, but all who know the truth, because of the truth which abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us from God the Father and from Jesus Christ the Father's Son, in truth and in love. You see a strong theological emphasis here at the outset of this epistle. The opening not only sets the tone of pastoral care, but also highlights distinctive emphases of this epistle, truth and love. And then throughout the body of the epistle, as is generally the case with all three of these epistles, doctrine and ethics are closely interwoven. The body of the letter is driven by an intense and sometimes urgent exhortatory tone, verses 5, 8, 10, 11, and so on. At the closing, the author expresses a wish to see face to face the people to whom he is talking to complete his joy. There's a strong pastoral note associated with it. And then a final greeting, the children of your elect sister, another highly metaphorical reference to the church, likely from which John is writing. And then we find some similar features in 3 John with an epistolary opening, a body, and a closing, the elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in the truth. And then the closing is not particularly remarkable, but you'll notice again the distinctive emphases, especially in the opening, whom I love in the truth. Again, these letters are written to counter falsehood, and there's therefore a strong emphasis upon the truth, what is true as opposed to the false, and what is deviant from the truth. In the body, once again, there's a tight interweaving of the doctrine and the ethics. And I refer you to the intensity of the tone of this letter, as well as evidence in verses 2, 8, 10, 11. There's intense exhortation going on here in the letter. Now, let's talk a bit about the distinctive theological idiom associated with these letters, the kind of voice in which they speak theologically. We begin with the Christology, and we notice, as we've already observed, a close correlation with the Gospel of John. We find pastoral applications of that Gospel's emphases to the life and ministry of the Church in these writings. The death of Jesus Christ and the benefits of that death are strongly emphasized, 1 John 1, 7-9. There's the strong emphasis upon fellowship with the Son and the Father, 1 John 1, 3 and 7. Cleansing from sin and unrighteousness, 1 John 1, 7 and 9. Jesus' death as propitiation for the sins of the world, 1 John 2, verse 2, 4, verse 10. Eternal life, being born of God, 1 John 2, 25 and 29, 3, 9, 5, 14, 18 and 19, 20. 3 John 11. Also associated with the death of Jesus Christ and the benefits of that death, we find a strong emphasis upon the incarnation of Christ. This is seems to be set within a somewhat polemical context. There were those who obviously denied that the Word had become flesh, and John is countering this tendency. 1 John 2, 22, 4, verses 2 and 3, 5, 1, verses 5 to 8, 2 John 7. You might compare an emphasis upon truth and true revelation of God in Jesus Christ, characteristic of the Gospel of John. John goes to a lot of trouble in these letters to establish the identity of the Son of God with the earthly Jesus. And here we might recall the Gospel's own emphasis upon Jesus' earthly ministry and the range of that ministry from the time he showed up on the scene, the time of his baptism, to his death. And there might be echoes of that in 1 John 5, verses 5 to 8. Who is it that overcomes the world but he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God? This is he who came by water and blood, Jesus Christ, not with the water only, but with the water and the blood. And the Spirit is the witness, because the Spirit is the truth. There are three witnesses, the Spirit, the water, and the blood, and these three agree. I think it's provocative to think about this as a kind of reference to the whole of the story of Jesus as it's recorded for us in the gospel tradition generally, not just the Gospel of John. And of course, it almost goes without saying that there's a distinct emphasis in these writings upon the Holy Spirit. We shouldn't be surprised because of the Johannine background for them. 1 John 2, verse 20, 3:24, 4:4, 7:13, 5:7, and 8. There's a strong Trinitarian focus characteristic of these writings, which ought not surprise us. 1 John 2, 20-27, 4, 13-15, 5, 6-12, 2 John verses 3 and 4, and also verse 9. And we see the range of titles for Christ that we expect from the gospel tradition. Jesus, Jesus Christ, the Son, strong accent upon the Father-Son relationship, and so on. Now let's take a brief look at the ethics associated with these writings. We can identify as an overarching principle the ethic of love. The writer exposes the hypocrisy of claiming to love God without loving brothers, without loving our brothers and sisters, without loving other people. 1 John 4, 16 and 17. Look back to 3, verse 17, and then 2 John as a whole, so on and so forth. It's the overarching principle of love that drives the ethic, and of course that love is founded in Jesus Christ and the manifestation of the love of God through Jesus Christ and the power of love which has been unleashed by his ministry and by the giving of the Spirit. I think these are all assumed by the writer. We get some insight into church organization and authority in these writings. And notice 1 John and 3 John's use of we, implying a kind of plurality of the exercise of authority in the early church, an emphasis upon the exercise of leadership, not on the part of a single individual who has a particular office, to whom, therefore, certain authority is attached, but it seems that in the life of the early church, fairly consistently, leaders exercise their authority as a plurality of leadership, and we have tended to follow that in various forms with plurality of leadership in various types of church structure throughout church history. Let's talk finally here about the Johannine vision of belief and doctrine, looking at the inseparable relationship between the two and how that comes to the fore in the language of these writings. And let me just highlight some of the expressions that accent all the more the tight connection between knowing the truth and doing the truth, or between doctrine and practice. You have the expression, abide in him, 1 John 2:6, and you might refer also to the Gospel of John chapter 15. Keep his commandments, 1 John 2, verse 3. Do the truth, 1 John 1, verse 6, and so forth. Do what is right, 1 John 3, verse 10. The contrast between loving in word and speech versus deed and truth, 1 John 3, verse 18. The expression, the truth which abides in us, 2 John, verse 2. The expression, abide in the doctrine, 2 John, verse 9. The expression, the truth of your life, 3 John, verse 3. Follow the truth, 3 John, verse 4. Here we notice the accent not upon knowing the truth, but upon following it. That is, living it out. Again, we can think back to expressions in Paul and other places we've encountered in the Petrine writings, adorning the doctrine and doing the good. Fellow workers in the truth, 3 John, verse 8. And finally, the expression, do good, 3 John, verse 11. All of these expressions establish that within the frame of reference of the writer, there is not a neat divide between knowing the truth and doing the truth. Doctrine is not doctrine unless it is lived out. There's the fundamental assumption that doctrine is going to be lived out, is going to show itself in life and in practice, else it's not worthy of the name doctrine or theology. Finally, we might end with a quote from the Introduction to the New Testament by Carson, Moo, and Morris, published by Zondervan, pages 445 and following, which I think summarizes well what these writings are all about. Quote, virtually all sides agree that John lays down three tests. Number one, true believers must believe that Jesus truly is the Christ come in the flesh, and this belief must work itself out in righteousness and love. This is the end of cassette number 11, New Testament Theology.